Thank you very much to Rabbi Kelman. It's a pleasure to be here again with a Torah in Motion talk. I hope the technical issues won't be a problem. If you can't hear me, I guess you should write a chat. Okay. But apparently so far from my end, it's working. Okay. Thank you very much. Anyway, last time that I gave a course earlier in the year, or actually early last year, I talked about the Karaites, and some people might think that the Karaites are a controversial issue. After all, they're a sect of Judaism that Rabbinic Judaism considers to be heretical, and there are many debates between Karaites and followers of Rabbinic Judaism, Rabbinites, over the years. And some of you might think then that a talk about Jewish philosophy wouldn't be controversial, because, after all, some of our greatest Jewish thinkers, Maimonides, for instance, were philosophers, and what could be controversial about that? But we know from Jewish history that attempts to understand Judaism rationally, attempts to follow rationalism and reason, can be very controversial. And in fact, there were quite a number of Maimonidean controversies in the Middle Ages. Didn't come out to violence, but it did cause a lot of unhappiness. And bans and excommunications. And even to today, we see that there are certain groups in the traditional community who are in favor of using reason, open to philosophy, open to science, open to general education. And there are others who feel that this is a form of heresy, or could at least lead to heresy. So what I'd like to do in this series of four lectures, is discuss some of the methods and some of the conclusions of Jewish philosophers through the ages. And even though the title is How to Become a Jewish Philosopher, How to Be a Jewish Philosopher, you probably won't learn that from this course. And you certainly won't get a diploma. We don't give out certificates or licenses to do Jewish philosophy. But I'm hoping that at least get some idea of the history of how different Jews have reacted to the problem of faith and reason. One of the questions to begin with is there such a thing as Jewish philosophy? Now, if I think that philosophy is an objective field of study and that it's a universal truth, then it'd be difficult to say that something is specifically Jewish philosophy. What then would make it Jewish? Why would it be specific to a particular people? And of course, when one looks at other fields of intellectual endeavor, let's say mathematics or physics or chemistry or biology, one doesn't usually say Jewish mathematics or Jewish philosophy, Jewish biology, or Jewish chemistry. Now, it is true that there are people who say there's a certain thing called Jewish logic, of which the first theorem is, if P, why not Q? And there are other people who say there's such a thing as Jewish mathematics, which would be gematria. I often say that there's Jewish physics, that the first rule of Jewish physics is the amount of time it takes to get ready for Shabbos is the amount of time you have plus 5 minutes. But this is not exactly I'd say scientific, and obviously most people don't see physics, for instance, as particularly a Jewish pursuit rather than other people. So what then can we call Jewish philosophy? Jewish philosophy is an attempt to understand the Jewish tradition, to explain the Jewish tradition, to present the Jewish tradition in light of the general philosophy, of the day. It's an attempt to, I don't want to say compete, but engage the philosophy of the day and try to present Judaism in light of that. Now, if we're talking about Judaism and philosophy, or Judaism and reason, what we're basically talking about is two different sources of truth. And these two sources of truth, these two different sources of truth, have different ground rules. They have different sources. They have different ways of attaining the truth. So, for instance, if we look at the Bible, you open the Bible, in the beginning, God created heaven and earth. There's no explanation what God means or who God is or how we know that God exists. There's no explanation of creation. There's no explanation of the heaven and the earth. There are assumptions and presuppositions in religious truth, in the truth that we get from revelation. And this is different from the approach or the methodology of philosophy. Some of you may be familiar with a person who's often thought to be the founder of modern philosophy. We can debate that, but Descartes, Rene Descartes, the Frenchman, that started out with doubt. He says, let's assume we don't know anything. And if we don't know anything and we don't trust anything, that we can't be sure of anything, I think that I'm giving a lecture with 80 participants I see now in the chat area of Zoom, but perhaps this is just an illusion. Maybe I'm having a dream, and you can decide whether it's a good dream or a bad dream, but I'm having a dream, and I'm being deluded. So Descartes says, well, let's say this is true. Let's say I think incorrectly that I'm giving a lecture to 80 people, or now 79 if I want somebody. All right, let me assume that. Who is doing the assuming? I am doing the assuming. And therefore, if I am assuming something, even if I'm being deceived, there's still an I. I have to exist. And of course, you know the famous, I think, therefore I exist. The cogito ergo sum, the highlight, the cornerstone of Descartes' philosophy. In fact, so much so that tell the story of Descartes went into a bar and the bartender says, would you like a drink? And he says, I think not. And suddenly he disappeared. Anyway, this is the philosophical view. This is a philosophical attitude. Start with doubt. Don't assume anything. Don't come with presuppositions. Ask questions. If you're going to say something, if you're going to claim something if you're going to say something as a fact, prove it. Use argumentation. And then we look at the Bible, we look at Revelation. The prophets come and declare things. They say, this is what God says. And the people don't say to them, well, prove to me that God that said this. Prove to me that God exists. All right? This is something different than the philosophical methodology. So we have basically two different epistemological systems. Now, epistemology is fancy word in philosophy. Basically, it means the science of knowledge, how we know things. And as I often tell my children, talk about my children, of my five children at age around four, I would say three of them were epistemologists. What do I mean by that? No matter what I said to them, they would say back to me, how do you know? How much longer are we going to be in the car? Oh, it's going to be a half an hour. How do you know? That's an epistemological question. So the epistemology are people who say, how do we know? And if you ask the philosopher how we know, the philosopher will say, my reason tells me, or I have figured this out, or I've experienced it, or I've experimented. And if you ask the religionist, how do you know? The religionist will say, well, God told me. Or the God told the prophets who told me. Or God told the prophets who told the sages who told me. Or God told the prophets who told the sages who told the teachers who told, eventually told my parents, and my parents told me. So this is the problem of these two different sources of truth. Now, there are also different strategies as to how to deal with these different sources if they should be in conflict. One strategy is to say, well, the Bible tells me, God told the prophets, religion doesn't change, science is changing all the time. What Aristotle thought was true about physics, he was found out by Newton to be wrong. What Newton thought about physics was found out by Einstein to be wrong. And what Einstein thinks about physics, well, who knows when someone will come up with non-Einsteinian physics. And the same thing with biology. Now we have idea of evolution. Who knows how long that will be considered correct science. So I'm going to take the Bible, and I'm going to ignore science. I'm going to ignore reason. I'm going to ignore philosophy. Or one could do it the other way around and say, I believe what reason tells me. Why should I accept what the Bible says? I don't know who gave the Bible. I don't know who wrote the Bible. The biblical critics say the Bible is written over a long period of time. The prophets might have said very nice things, but maybe they deluded. And how do I know that my Bible is correct and the Christian edition, the New Testament, is not correct, or the Quran isn't correct, or the Eastern religions aren't correct? Everybody has his own revelation or sacred books. How do I know that what I believe is correct and what you believe is incorrect? And therefore, I'm going to follow reason. Reason is universal. Reason is objective. And even if philosophers disagree or scientists disagree, they're using the correct method. And then there are those who say, I don't accept anything. I don't think revelation is true. I don't think reason is true. You can get skepticism that's deny any way of arriving at the truth. As Rapsodia Gaon pointed out, even those who say nothing is true still act the way as if things are true. They still are careful when they're crossing the street. They still have to take into account a certain amount of knowledge. Or one could say that they are both true. And then you come to the problem, if you say reason is true and revelation is true, if there is a conflict between them, how do I know which one is the real truth? So all these solutions are not perfect. And what I want to do with this series of lectures is discuss some of the solutions that Jewish thinkers have used to the problem of faith and reason or science and religion over the years. Let me just add one more thing, which is, why should this be a problem? Why should I say to myself, I'll listen to my reason rather than listen to the Bible? If I believe in the Bible, if I believe in the truths of Judaism, if I believe that God created the world, and I believe that God created me, and if I believe God created me and God gave me a reason, then why would God want to give me reason which would mislead me? And as Descartes also said, that God would not deceive us. God is not a deceiver. And therefore, if we have reason, it's also God-given. So if I believe that the Bible is given by God and my reason is given by God, then I have a problem of how to reconcile the two of them. Now, when did this problem arise? This problem is not a new one. This problem is not from 50 years ago, 100 years ago. It's thousands of years old. Some of the first people to deal with the problem of religion and reason were the Greeks themselves. After all, the Greeks had mythology. They had beliefs in gods. They had certain folk beliefs. And come the philosophers and sort of played down or showed that these mythological beliefs were not the way the world came about. So there were already in the Greek world some people trying to reconcile Greek philosophy and Greek mythology. But in the Jewish world, the first person to do it was a Alexandrian Jew, Alexandria of Egypt, named Philo of Alexandria, Philo Judaeus. Alexandria at that time was a large Hellenistic city, Greek-speaking. Some of you may know the synagogue there was so large that they had to give instructions by flying flags or showing flags one way or another so people would know what's going on. Anyway, Philo was a believer in the Bible, and Philo lived at the change of the eras. In other words, probably born before the year 1 of the Common Era. He died around year 40 of the common era. In other words, he was a contemporary of Jesus, but a totally different world. We're not even sure that Philo himself knew Hebrew. So Philo, in his secular training, was a Platonist. In his religious training, he was Jewish. And if you read Plato, you find out that Plato believed the world was created out of prime matter. In other words, there was matter which always exists, like sort of a clay out there. And one day, an artisan, it's called the Demiurgus, an artist took this clay and formed the world. And how did the artist know how to form the world? By looking at the Platonic ideas. According to Plato, ideas are universal, not only the idea of love or the idea of one or the idea of good, but chair, there's the ideal chair, there's the ideal house, there's the ideal food. And by looking at these ideas, eternal ideas, the artist knew how to take this clay and form it into a world. Now, some of you might be familiar with the Midrash Bereishit Rabbah, Genesis Rabbah, where some of these ideas could be found. For instance, the idea that God looked at the Torah and created the world. So you have an idea that there is something that God used as his pattern for creating the world. But what about prime matter? There always was matter. There's always things there before God created the world. Well, Philo said, okay, Plato is right that there was prime matter. The Bible is right the way he understood it, that the world was created from nothing. And it's not clear that that's what the Bible says. We'll talk about it next week. But where did the prime matter come from, said Philo? So Philo said, God created prime matter, as the Bible says, and then from the prime matter made the world, as Plato said. So here we have a compromise between these two different systems. Now, Philo had a very interesting idea of being both a Jew and also a committed philosopher, but the Jewish tradition did not pick this up. Jews stopped. The Greek Jewish community, there still is a Greek Jewish community, but the massive community that produced the Septuagint, the translation of the Bible to Greek, and produced the Philo and other Jews who were Hellenistic Jews, that did not become mainstream in Judaism. That community more or less disappeared. What became mainstream in Judaism is Rabbinic Judaism, the Judaism of the rabbis, of the Mishnah, the Talmud. And they weren't interested in philosophy, and they didn't have a conflict with it. They probably didn't know very much about Greek philosophy. But another religious group that believed in the Bible and believed in philosophy and was made up more and more overwhelmingly of Gentiles of the Hellenistic world, that religion is called Christianity. And the Christians said, wow, we have a problem also. We have a problem because we believe in revelation. We believe in certain things about God and about humanity and about the Messiah, who was God incarnate. And yet this doesn't seem to agree with what we know from philosophy. And we need to explain these ideas using philosophical rational explanations. So the early Christians, those who developed Christian theology, those who call the church fathers, used their knowledge of Greek philosophy, used their knowledge of the Bible to come up with a theology which would explain, or philosophical, I'd say either theology or we say philosophical explanations to their theological ideas. Christianity, as you know, spread. There became more and more Christians, and Christian theology, philosophy was also developed, was translated both in Western Europe, Northern Europe, into Latin, but in the Middle East was translated into a type of Aramaic called Syriac. So we have an Eastern church. This very day, still day, we still have an Eastern church, not as strong as it used to be. It's under Islam, has suffered greatly since the 7th century. But the Christians, the Eastern Christians, translated Greek philosophy and used Greek philosophy. And suddenly, in 622, Muhammad flees from Mecca to Medina. He's trying to set up a new religion, religion of Islam. And 10 years later, when Muhammad dies in 632, Islam is well established. 100 years later, Islam rules from Spain all the way to India. It's a massive religious movement. Some of you may be familiar with this idea that Islam spread with the book in one hand and the sword in the other hand. So they had a book and they had a sword and they captured the world. The book being, of course, the Quran, the sword meaning by war, by jihad, holy war. I have a colleague, Islamist, who says that he doesn't really believe that because it's very hard to ride on a horse if one hand has a book and one hand has a sword. So Islam spread not only by the sword, but also by conviction, by influencing people, by convincing them of the truth of Islam. But the Muslims had a problem. The problem was they had a book, they had a belief, they had a new religion, but they didn't really have a theology. They also had a problem with law. They had to develop their laws, which we won't discuss, but they had to develop their theology. And a lot of the development of theology was in the context of debates with the Christians. So, for instance, when the Muslims found Christians, they'd say, well, you believe in three gods. And the Quran says God is one, not three. And the Christians said, no, we believe in one God. That one God has three persons, has three characters, has three characteristics, has three attributes, descriptions, but it's still one God. So the Christians are using Greek philosophy to explain why one God, three persons, three aspects is allowable. And the Muslims said, well, we better learn this philosophy so we can answer them, and which is what they did. So the medieval philosophy we know it, starting, say, 7th, 8th century, is a combination of Christian thought and Muslim thought. The Jews get into it a little bit later. Let me talk a little bit about the Muslim idea. The Muslim theology, the early philosophical theology, was something called Kalam, K-A-L-A-M. It means word. In Arabic, means word, but it's sort of theology. It's the word about God. And what the Muslims decided was that the most important thing was the first step of theology and philosophy would be to prove the existence of God. And the way they proved the existence of God was by proving the creation of the world. So they said, let's prove that the world was created. Once we prove the world is created, we know there has to be a creator. The creator, therefore, is God. And this became a highlight of their theology. In fact, they were known as the people of unity and justice because unity of God, proving the existence of God, and then discussing the nature of God. It's interesting. Maimonides thinks that this is a backwards way of doing things because Maimonides says methodologically, if we prove the existence of God on the basis of the creation of the world, if someone can prove the world is eternal, then our proof that God exists falls. So Maimonides says, let's prove the existence of God on the basis of the eternity of the world. And then if the world is actually created, then God also exists because the world needs a creator. So this was Maimonides' idea, but the Kalam, the followers of the Kalam, including the first Jewish followers of the Kalam, accepted this idea to try to prove the existence of God by proving the creation of the world. And there is one other aspect. They said, the justice of God, where everything had to be justified, that what God did, we had to explain. This is especially a group of followers of the Kalam called the Mu'tazila. The Mu'tazila, like the separatists. And to give you an example of how their thinking went, I'll talk about the story of the founding of the second school of Kalam called Asherism. I don't have a way of showing you how these words are written. It won't be on the final exam, so you don't have to worry about learning these words. But in the meanwhile, the story is told about a Muslim, Al-Ashari, who was sitting in class with his Mu'tazi-like teacher, Al-Jubai. And Al-Jubai was explaining why children in paradise, in the Garden of Eden, have less reward than the adults in the Garden of Eden. So Al-Jubai is explaining that your place in the world to come is a function of how many merit points you accumulated during your lifetime. And which point, and therefore adults have more reward than children. At which point Ashari asked, well, wait, so why did these children die as children? Why didn't God let them live to be adults? And when they became adults, as adults, they would have more credit points and have more reward in the world to come. So always having to justify God, Al-Jubai said, oh, because God knew that these children, if they'd grown up, would have become sinners. And therefore, it was to their benefit to die as children, to have a little reward in heaven, in the Garden of Eden, rather than having great punishment in the afterlife. At that point, according to the story, the gates of hell opened up and the people, the sinners there, cried out, why didn't God kill us when we were children? So we could have had a little bit of reward and not this terrible punishment that we're having. At this point, Al-Ashari said, I can't accept this anymore. And he founded his own school of thought, which was based on the idea that everything is according to God's will. Okay. So I've talked about the background, I've talked about Greece, I've talked about theory, I've talked about epistemology, I've talked about methodology, I talked about the church fathers, I talked about the Muslims. Let's now talk about Jews. The first medieval Jewish philosopher whose name we know is Dawood ibn Mirwan Amukamas. Now, if we were in person rather than on Zoom, and I could see all of you rather than just pictures, whatever, I'd say, how many people have heard of Dawood ibn Mirwan Amukamas? And I would guess that not very many people will have heard of him. He was in the mid-ninth century. We know about him that he converted. He was Jewish. He converted to Christianity, studied under Christian teachers, then returned to Judaism and wrote books criticizing Christianity. He also has a book of polemic against Buddhism. Unfortunately, it's lost. That would be very interesting. And he wrote a book of philosophy. But as someone else in the chat I see points out, that the person who is usually called the first medieval Jewish philosopher was Rav Sadia Gaon. Rav Sadia Gaon lived from 882 to 942, which means he was approximately 100 years after this Amukamas. And the reason you've heard of him rather than Amukamas gives me an opportunity to give two pieces of advice. If after this series of lectures you still want to be Jewish philosophers, there are two things I can suggest to you. The first thing is do something else as well. If Rav Sadia Gaon had only done philosophy, probably his faith would have been like Amukamas. But Sadia Gaon was the head of yeshiva. Sadia wrote history. Sadia was a polemicist against Karaites, in terms of the calendar. Sadia wrote poetry. Sadia wrote history. Sadia wrote commentaries on the Bible. Sadia translated the entire Bible into Arabic, into Judeo-Arabic, Jewish Arabic, right? So Sadia was a major, major, major figure who also did theology and philosophy in two major books. One is Commentary on the Book of Creation, a sort of mystical book, But the important one, the one that's most well known, is the Book of Opinions and Emunot V'Dayot, Beliefs and Opinions. There's different ways of translating that into English. So that's the first thing that Sadia did, which is important. He did other things besides just Jewish theology or philosophy. The second hint is, if you want to be remembered as a Jewish philosopher, write in Hebrew, or make sure someone translates your work, not in Hebrew, into Hebrew. It doesn't have to be done immediately, but certainly over the course of time. So the Sadia, writing in the early 10th century, 933 is his Book of Beliefs and Opinions. This was translated in the 12th century. But it was translated when Jews started to read Hebrew rather than Arabic. It was translated. Amukamas, part of it was translated, but almost most of it was not. All right. So Sa'adja Gaon was a Gaon in the modern Israeli sense, being a genius, but he was also a Gaon in the sense of being the head of a yeshiva in Babylonia. He came originally from Egypt. He was such an outstanding character and so talented that he was made the head of the yeshivot in Babylonia, today's Iraq, even though they were usually, I want to say, family businesses, but you had to have a certain amount of yichus to be considered there, your family genealogy background. But Sa'adja was just too important to ignore. Some of you, I won't go into the whole history of him. He was a very strong-headed person. He got into a fight with the Exilarch. The Exilarch is the political head of the Jews in Babylonia. There was a while that he was out of the job of being the go and the head of the yeshiva. All right. Someone asked whether theology is philosophy. No, I wouldn't say that is. I would say that theology is not philosophy. The Jewish philosophy, the people that are engaged in the use of reason, are doing it in order to develop theologies, understandings of God. I won't go into give strict definitions or exact definitions. A little bit difficult. Theology is discussions of God. Philosophy deals with a great deal more. The reason I use theology when I'm talking about someone like Sa'adja is because his use of philosophy was for the understanding of God and the understanding of Judaism, so that's more a theological use of the philosophy. Sa'adja's great assumption was that we accept revelation on the basis of prophecy. We saw the prophets, at least our ancestors did. The prophets did miracles. We, ancestors and then us, accept what the prophets told us. And then we can use reason to corroborate what the prophets had to say. In other words, we don't say, first, let's use our reason and see what's true. No, we first know what's true, and then we just use our reason to corroborate it. That shows you very clearly why Sa'adja was not the type of philosopher like Descartes, who starts with the absolute doubt. Sa'adja says, I start with the truth, but I want to be able to demonstrate this truth is true even from the point of view of reason. This is an assumption of early medieval Jewish philosophy, this idea that one could prove the truth of Judaism. By the end of the Middle Ages, the Jewish thinkers were saying, well, we can't prove certain historical beliefs, but we can show that they're not irrational, that Judaism is not an irrational religion. Judaism is a religion that can be demonstrated to be in accord with reason, what can be demonstrated, what can be proved, but it's not necessarily provable by religion. And Jewish thinkers who developed this idea toward the late end of the Middle Ages, among other reasons, did it to say the difference between Judaism and the other religions is the other religions have irrational elements. The other religions are not in accord with reason, and therefore Judaism is a true religion because it doesn't contradict reason. Anyway, this was Saadia in the 10th century. We'll talk about, all the people will talk about more in the coming weeks. The next thinker that I'd like to mention is Judah Halevi, born around 1075, died in 1141. Now, I saw the Professor Kaplan in the chat mentioned Bachia ben Papuda. Bachia wrote around 1080. He was a Dayan, he was a judge, but he's not known for his any halakhic works, but he follows the rule of being translated into Hebrew pretty early. He was one of the first books, his book, The Duties of the Heart, was one of the first ones translated into Hebrew in the 12th century, the great translation project of the Ibn Tibbon family. And Bachia's work is more ethics. It's a guide to how one perfects one's life and gets close to God. He's not as interested in some of the philosophical or scientific issues that of the other speakers, the other thinkers I'll be speaking about. Anyway, Judah Halevi, I'm sure, is known to most people. Among other things, there's in almost every city in Israel, there's a street named after him. He was a great poet. He's known for his love of Israel and the fact that at the end of his life, he actually made Aliyah. He got to the land of Israel, despite all the difficulties starting in Spain and stopping off in Egypt. And the legend has it, and it's pretty hard to substantiate this legend, but the legend has it that he got to the gates of Jerusalem, prostrated himself, sang his song. He proclaimed his poem, Sion Alo Tishali L'Shlom HaSilach, Sirayev, Zion, won't you inquire into the welfare of your prisoners. And at that point, he was run over by a Muslim horseman who killed in an early traffic accident. It's hard to substantiate this. Also, when Halevi got to the land of Israel in 1141, it was under the Crusaders and not the Muslims. But it is true that once he got to the land of Israel, his tracks were lost, and we know in a few months after he got there, he was no longer alive. Anyway, the most famous book that Judah Halevi wrote, the one book that he wrote, is called The Kuzari. The Kuzari is based on an historical event, which is the conversion of a people called Khazars. The Khazars lived in Central Asia between the Caspian and the Black Sea. And this is a medieval kingdom where the king and apparently most of the people of the kingdom converted to Judaism. The story of the Khazars is quite intriguing, and there are many people who doubt that it's really true, that it really happened. But as far as we can tell, I would say the latest reliable research into the Khazars is that they were Jewish. They may have been Jewish because they were on the buffer between the Byzantine Christians and the Persian and Iraqi Muslims. But still, the story went that we know from correspondence between a king of Khazars and a prominent Jewish statesman in Spain, Chastai ibn Shaprut, there's a correspondence in the 10th century where this king of the Khazars named Joseph, tells about how the original Jewish king of the Khazars, Bulan, had a dream which was kept on being told by an angel to look for the correct religion. And on the basis of this dream, according to this letter, the king converted, found Judaism and converted to Judaism. So Judah Halevi in the 12th century used this story and made the Book of Kuzari as a dialogue between the Khazar king and the Jewish sage, the Khaver. Before the king goes to the Jew, the king first inquires about philosophy. In this case, it's Aristotelian philosophy, the 12th century. And then he called a Christian, and then he called a Muslim, and he wasn't satisfied with any of them and figured he had to call a Jew. At first, he didn't want to call a Jew, and he said the Jews are obviously don't have the truth. They are oppressed, they're discriminated against, they suffer, Christians and Muslims are strong, and therefore he wanted to call a Jew. Then he decided that he had no choice to call a Jew, and the rest of the book is dedicated to explaining Judaism by this chaver, by this Jewish sage. And interestingly enough, it's the beginning, not the end of the book, but the beginning of the second book, second part of the five parts of the book of Kuzari, the king actually converts to Judaism, and then he asks for more information. The end of the book, the Jewish interlocutor, the Jewish protagonist, the chaver, informs the king that he's leaving for the land of Israel. The king says, why do you want to do that? And he explains this is important, that Israel is central for Jewish life. The king says, oh, but it's dangerous. What do you want to do this for? And one can hear the king's words, sort of an echo of the way Judah Halevi's neighbors among the Spanish Jewish intellectuals, they probably said the same things to him. It's dangerous. Where do you want to go? We're happy here. Spain is fine. And Judah Halevi says, no, just like the Chaver, the sage says no. And he goes to the land of Israel. So that will be the second important work that we'll be discussing in the coming weeks. And the third one is that of Maimonides, the Guide of the Perplexed. Some of you may be following the weekly Torah reading. Today is Thursday. The reading is the beginning of, I think, chapter 15 in Exodus, where the Pharaoh decides to run after the Jews and the Israelites that he just freed from slavery. And he says about them, Nebuchim heim ba'aretz. They are confused in the land. They are lost. They don't know what's going on. They don't know where to go. And that in Hebrew was a translation of Maimonides' book Moreh Nebuchim, The Guide of the Perplexed. I don't know if it's Maimonides' term himself, a title. He called it in Arabic, Dalalat al-Hayarin, The Guide of the Perplexed. Maimonides' book shows the full correspondence between Aristotelianism, between classical Greek philosophy as developed by Aristotle, and the Jewish tradition. And it's in his book that one sees the conflict, the great conflict between rationalism, between philosophy, the philosophy of Aristotle, and the teachings of the Torah. So if the Greek god of Aristotle is a unmoved mover, the one who moves the world but without being moved, itself, because certainly not himself, right? Who's a first cause but not a creator, that the world is eternal, that God doesn't know what people think, God doesn't know what people act, reward and punishment is not something that's going to be supernatural, it's not this the sort of accumulation of merits and then God rewards you or punishes you. That God doesn't talk specifically, choose particular people to talk to be prophets. There's all this view of a naturalistic world. Maimonides says, agrees with what the Torah teaches. The Torah uses allegory. The Torah uses examples. The Torah uses human speech. The Torah talks on a level of that people can understand. But the real message of the Torah is the truth of philosophy. And the Guide of the Perplexed, in a sense, deals with all these major philosophical issues and comes up with solutions. How good the solutions are, we'll discuss in the coming weeks. But certainly he thinks that it's possible to reconcile Judaism and philosophy, Judaism and rationalism. There is a question as to the extent, about the extent to which Maimonides really accepted some of the traditional Jewish beliefs over Aristotle. For instance, Maimonides says specifically that he believes in creation out of nothing. One can possibly, he says, believe in creation out of something, but he rejects Aristotelian eternalism, that the world is eternal. And yet there are many people who read the book, the Maimonides Guide, and said, ah, he's really hiding the fact that he believes in the eternity of the world. In other words, there are things which are hidden in the book. It's an esoteric book, and one has to read it very carefully to find out what Maimonides' real beliefs are. But at least on the surface, Maimonides defends most of the traditional beliefs of Judaism, but gives them twists which a lot of religionists would not agree with, and therefore that was the great Maimonidean controversy. I see also in the chat someone mentioned Neoplatonism, emanation. That was another form or school in medieval philosophy. Neoplatonism is a form of philosophy which was developed in the 3rd century, the Common Era, by Greek-speaking Plotinus. And the major idea is that the world is emanated from God, that just like the sun is able to produce rays of sun rays, heat and light, and does this without being diminished by itself, at least that's what I thought, so too God produces light, produces emanations, produces the wavelengths things coming out of God, not physical emanations, but spiritual emanations. And that's the way the world came to be, or that's the way the world exists. In terms of the medieval philosophy, there were those who adopted this idea of God emanating the world eternally, but emanating it, from Neoplatonism and added it to Aristotelianism. There are historical reasons. Some of the writings of Plotinus circulated in the Middle Ages under the name of Aristotle. Okay, someone asked me the question of what I mean by religionists. By religionists, I mean those people who have religion in the areas I'm talking about, be either Christians or Muslims or Jews. In other words, those who accepted the truth of religion in one way or another, who would have a problem with, let's say, rational attacks on the religion. Okay. The next 3 weeks, the first week will be about creation of the world and the existence of God. The next one will be about prophecy and the commandments. And the third one will be about problem of evil and providence. I've more or less taken up the time for today of talk, leaving time for questions. So even though I can't hear you, I can read the chat. So if there are any questions, please let me know. Maimonides says that the world couldn't come to be in existence by itself and therefore required God to create it. This begs the question of who created God, and if God could exist without being created, then why not the world? Okay, so it's not exactly what Maimonides says. We'll discuss it next week. But the indeed is a problem of having a creator, having a maker. And basically the argument from Sa'adja is the world came into existence and therefore had to have a creator who existed before the world. The world couldn't create itself. Therefore also God could not create itself. God, that self-creation is impossible. And therefore the assumption is if the world came into being, it had to be created by something that was before, and that something would be a creator God. Neoplatonism and Kabbalah is absolutely correct. Neoplatonism influenced Kabbalah tremendously. The 10 Sefirot, there are different interpretations as to the meaning and the origin of the idea of the 10 religious divine realms of the Sefirot. Some people see it as the emanations, the divine emanations. I'm not sure. Someone asked about a particular book. I'm not sure to what he's referring, to which one he's referring. There are a number of books in Jewish philosophy. In the last few years, both in Cambridge and Oxford, there have come handbooks of Leon Roth. Okay, so Leon Roth was a historian from many years ago. He was not really a... I think Cecil Roth. His brother was a historian. Leon Roth was a philosopher. I don't know to the extent to which he was a historian of the of philosophy. There are a number of books, but many of them are since it's a difficult subject, many of them are difficult to read, but, anyway. Source the struggle of early Christians to reconcile the Greek philosophy. I think the best work, would be Harry Wolfson's The Philosophy of the Church Fathers. Harry Wolfson was one of the greatest scholars of medieval philosophy, not only Jewish, but Christian and Muslim in the 20th century, was promoting a view that all the medieval philosophy is one phenomenon. It started with a Jew called Philo. It ended with a Jew called Spinoza. And everything that happened in between, whether it's Muslim philosophy, Christian philosophy, Jewish philosophy, was all one of the same process, just in different languages, using different sacred texts. So there's the book, The Philosophy of the Church Fathers, is Wolfson's attempt at showing how the Church Fathers, the Christian early Christians, used Philo, used the Philonic methodology of reconciling truth, reason with religion. Professor Kaplan advocates for Leon Roth's work. Akasha. Did Chazal dislike philosophy because of the Greeks or vice versa? Well, I think that Chazal really weren't familiar with philosophy. I mean, take, for instance, look at the history of Judaism. If you look at Jews who lived in Islamic countries, and then later on in Spain, which was started out as an Islamic country, they were familiar with philosophy, and therefore they were forced, in a sense, to compete with it. It's like you could say today that most Jews living in the West are familiar with Freud, are familiar with Darwin, are familiar with Einstein, one way or another, and therefore they find it important to deal with it. But any place, people who are not familiar with these modern or the general cultural intellectual achievements would not be bothered to try to justify Judaism or try to reconcile Judaism with them. So in France and Germany, Ashkenaz, medieval Ashkenaz, there's almost no philosophy because they weren't familiar with it. Even though the scholastics of the period were there, there was not part of the Jewish general culture, let me put it that way. And therefore there's no philosophy, very little philosophy in Ashkenazic works. So in the same way, the Chazal were not as familiar with Greek philosophy. Now, Simon Jay writes, but didn't the sages of the Mishnaic era debate with the Romans, would philosophy not have been part of those debates? Well, there are, I'd say, hints of it. There are questions, certainly philosophical questions, by the Romans. Sometimes the interlocutor with Jews is presented as a philosopher, sometimes as a heretic, sometimes as a Roman emperor. But given the prohibition of learning Greek philosophy, the prohibition of learning Greek Greek books, which we find in the Talmudic literature, presumably they didn't know it sufficiently, were not confronted with it sufficiently to try to integrate it into their beliefs. Okay. See, that's does Wilson's Wilson claim was the kind of Muslims have with Christians that compel them to deal with Greek philosophy? Yes, Wilson definitely argues that, Harry Wilson, that that many ideas of early Islamic theological philosophy were as a direct result of the contact and polemics with Christians. Okay. Also, recommendation for David Winston's book on Philo, Naomi Cohen's work on Philo. Okay. So thank you very much. And see you next week. Okay. Bye-bye.